Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Hey everybody, it's Jeff Patterson, and I am here, as always, with Mr. Fred Kiesch.
Good day, everyone. Hope you're cooler than we are in New Jersey at the moment.
We aren't down here in Atlanta. We're going to be pushing 90s for the foreseeable future. Nope. Anyways, in doing a lot of prep for the relaunch of this, we've been talking about comics and comic-related goods and what things that have been going on, and we got a few things we want to talk about tonight. We want to talk about Wildstorm, and we want to talk about some stuff with Vertigo as well. Wildstorm's been sort of going through a bit of a flux lately with the current Warren Ellis series, which is going to be ending, with a couple other books that he has planned that are going to be coming out. And I just keep remembering what a nightmare it was when they made Wildstorm part of the full-blown DC universe and the New 52, and how that just became a wreck. But, Fred, you have been reading Ellis's The Wildstorm, I take it.
Well, yes, because longtime fans of the show may remember that we did a whole episode on Warren Ellis several years ago. So, of course, ever since then, I've been reading more and more of his stuff. And in fact, in the last year, I read, Freak Angels, Global Frequency, Caught Up on Injection, Supreme Blue Rose, reread everything that's been done for the series Trees. And then I started reading Wildstorm, got through maybe half of it, and was hoping that the rest of it would come out before we would talk about it, but the final episode is something like Wednesday of this week, if everything goes right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I am a short-time reader, long-time confused, because when I first read it, I'm like, okay, obviously this relates to something, but what does it relate to? I had no knowledge of anything earlier. Even though with a little Googling, I did learn that some of the things I have read, like Authority, do tie in, but I didn't remember any connections when I got to this for some reason.
Yeah, well, Wildstorm was originally the Jim Lee portion of the Image universe when he was doing Stormwatch and Wildcats. Mm-hmm. And then DC bought it as an imprint. And they also launched things like a lot of Alan Moore books, America's Best Comics, Promethea, right. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. All of that came out under Wildstorm. So Ellis was doing quite a bit of work for that. And, you know, he did Planetary and The Authority.
Mm-hmm.
But Stormwatch and The Authority coming after that, as well as Wildcats, they sort of brought those storylines together in the course of the imprint through various writers. And what this particular revival was basically after the huge, crazy multiverse stuff that had happened in DC, they asked Ellis to revive the Wildstorm universe and reimagine it. And so he has been doing the Wildstorm. He also did another book called The Wildstorm Michael Cray, which sort of had this agent looking right. at the assorted DC characters in the Wildstorm universe. And there's going to be a new Wildcat series coming out this year as well that he says is going to be much more of a widescreen comic like his Authority stuff was.
This kind of started out, I mean, I reread the whole series over the weekend again, the stuff that I had reread before and read then some of the stuff for the first time. Now, in the first issue, he talks about, or he's being interviewed, and he's like, being asked, do you need to know about what has gone before in order to read this? And he says no. So, but as I'm reading this, it starts out with a relatively straightforward kind of like superhero story, but then you get aliens, you get, of course, all sorts of conspiracy theories, secret government agencies or quasi-government agencies. And then you kind of get leaking into magic with the daemons and whatever. So how much of this was in all these various precursor stories?
Well, the Wildcats, it's borrowing heavily from the original Wildcats storyline, but there wasn't so much corporate espionage going on.
corporate espionage with orbital launch kinetic kill weapons. I mean, that's
right. Yeah, there was, you know, they did play a lot with extraterrestrial races and astral forces and cosmic interests. And the Daemonites were certainly there, though they were always portrayed as an alien race. When Alan Moore did a run on the book, they actually went back to the planet that some of the characters were from and learned all about what's been going on the planet since they've been gone. And it had kind of gone to hell, and they sort of start up a little rebellion there. It was always one of my favorite little storylines. It's sort of odd that Alan Moore was able to make the Wildstorm universe such a home. He did a fantastic one-shot with Majestic, who was in Wildcats for a while and had his own book. But what Ellis is doing, my interpretation of what Ellis is doing, is taking a lot of the set pieces from those earlier runs of the book, those earlier iterations, and just sort of reseeding them almost in novel form.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, if you were going to take an entire line of comics that existed 15, 20 years ago and write a novel based on them, how might that go? I mean, I've been enjoying it. I'm behind a few issues. I've definitely been enjoying it. The fact that the art has such a... The art is deceptively complex. It looks very minimalist when you first look at it, and then you get into these more involved pieces, and you can see how complex it really is.
Oh, there's some beautiful full-page panels throughout the whole series, as well as, you know, the group shots and whatever, but there's some fantastic stuff. I was just like, as you may have seen me tweeting a couple of the images yesterday.
Yeah.
It's just like, wow, look at that, you know. It's such nice stuff. So I guess the conclusion is you don't need to know the previous stuff in order to enjoy it, because I certainly enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And doing my research about what came before is like, I don't think I can afford to untangle this particular cord and not of previous stories.
The thing about Wildcats is that when Jim Lee and Brandon Choi and a lot of other creators that were working for Marvel launched Image Comics as a home for creator-owned comics, they decided to really make the comic book as a format as artistic as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Lee really, I mean, if anything, he overachieved that goal with those first 7-8 issues of Wildcats. The covers were all incredibly complex. He spent a lot of time on the individual, you know, special effects that the various characters use as their superpowers. There were fonts all over the place to show different voices and different races. And of course, it was probably Jim Lee aside from his work on Batman, it was probably his most complex art. And, you know, it became a gag about Image Comics that everybody had too many pouches and too many big guns and too many bandoliers. And
right.
And every mask had a tie in the back, and the tie was always fluttering in the wind. And Jim Lee drew all of that, you know, beautifully. And it was very over the top. He was you know, attempting to out Marvel at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Image books were doing the same thing. Spawn came out around that time. Wetworks. There were a number of books that were really trying to, you know, do what they thought creator-owned superhero comics should be doing. And there was, you know, there was some backlash from it, and there was some heavy-duty fandom pushback in some regards. But in other regards, a lot of people just accepted them for what they were, you know?
Right.
And at the same time, you had the speculator crisis that, you know, where people were buying up 15, 20 copies of every variant cover that you could. And a lot of people viewed Image as sort of a symptom of what was wrong with comics when it was, in fact, making a splash. In fact, Mark Waid and Alex Ross did the comic Kingdom Come for DC, which was about all the DC heroes in the future. And it was interpreted by many as Mark Waid's criticism of the Image universe, that the Image universe had no moral compass, and that this was a story about members of the Justice League, you know, Superman, Batman, Aquaman, everybody, Green Lantern, having to repair the damage that this ersatz Image universe that had incurred onto the world had done. And you know, it was sort of a pushback against grim and gritty as well, which is what a lot of Image books were criticized right. for, and not unfairly, but I mean, those were the quintessential Image years, those first few, you know, from 1992. But you know, once again, you can make that criticism, but at the same time, Chris Claremont was writing for them, and Alan Moore was writing for them, and they were getting art by people like Travis Charest, or mm-hmm. Charest, I always pronounce his name incorrectly. Top-tier work. I think they pretty much justified their own existence by doing things like that. I mean, some of the stuff that Alan Moore did, especially with Supreme, that was a spectacular book that he was writing when he took over Rob Liefeld's Supreme. That was an excellent book. It was an excellent tribute to the fact that Superman has a history, not just the modern iterations that tend to be somewhat overdrawn, but also the fact that he had this rather whimsical past where, you know, Superman books used to be one-shot books with a strange conundrum on the cover, and then he'd have to solve something during the course of the story, and it would tie into something later. And that's what Moore was doing with Supreme. He was showing that, you know, comics have various stages in their history, and there have been different iterations that have changed over time. And I thought he illustrated that beautifully. Plus his tribute to Jack Kirby, just a wonderful piece of work where Supreme basically gets trapped going through all the various Kirby worlds.
Yeah.
That was a great book. But America's Best Comics that Alan Moore wrote as well was also a tribute to comic books past, and he was doing this while he was doing some groundbreaking work as well. So, but that's that, and the 90s were the 90s.
Well, if the 90s were the 90s, the 80s were the 80s, and I recall the 80s was when Watchmen came out under a different imprint, correct?
Yeah, Watchmen was a straight DC book.
Oh, it wasn't Vertigo originally?
I don't think we okay. had Vertigo at the time.
Okay.
But that and The Dark Knight Returns mm-hmm. were sort of the books that sort of set the tone for everything that happened in the 90s as well. So, but it's funny that you mentioned Vertigo, because we recently heard the news that Vertigo was no longer going to be an imprint, that DC was basically getting rid of it. And one of the reasons that was given was they felt that the rest of comics had sort of caught up with what Vertigo was doing at the time that it had come out.
Right.
And there's something to be said for that, because in the wake of Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns and attempts to make comics in general a little darker, Vertigo was an attempt to be able to tell stories about the fantastic and about weird things. I mean, Vertigo really sort of embraced what later became known as weird fiction, sometimes overlapping with the DC universe, sometimes in a separate universe. I mean, Sandman certainly showed up in some DC comics. Swamp Thing did. Constantine did. Alan Moore had a whole book planned called Twilight of the Superheroes that was going to take place near the end of the universe. And the main character in it was John Constantine, even though the rest of the characters were future Superman, future Captain Marvel, etc. But what Vertigo was doing was taking a lot of these, you know, horror and fantasy tropes that these creators were doing, and really trying to make them content exclusively for adults, I mean, Gaiman did Black Orchid. You know, there were so many books that came out from that period, and it really exploded. I mean, as soon as that happened, everybody else tried sort of getting in on that bandwagon. A couple other comic companies started doing what they considered to be adult content books. They actually had warnings on the covers. So to me, it's kind of understandable. I mean, that you would have DC really look at the imprint and see if it's worth keeping around. I mean, it certainly achieved what it set out to do. And now that they're, you know, revisiting so many of the Vertigo properties, now that we have a new Sandman book and a new Dreaming book and a new Lucifer book, to me, it's a case of these things that were supposed to be edgy and kind of underground are definitely mainstream now.
Right.
And for me, keeping Vertigo as an imprint one way or the other really isn't going to change the quality of the books.
I mean, yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, you do lose an identity. You know, if you look at how book publishing has changed, I mean, you had Del Rey, Bantam, Ace, Pyramid, etc. You always knew what to expect with each of those imprints.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they all started consolidating. And I don't even know if there's such thing as a Del Rey book at this point anymore. but, you know, so many different publishers have merged together that it's kind of a loss. It's a loss.
I would agree with you to an extent. I mean, I certainly miss laser books and Timescape books and imprints like, you know, right, that nature that we used to have on a regular basis, because you knew what you were getting. But at the same time, DC in particular, editorially, has kind of been all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
And when Vertigo first started, there was a degree of a shared universe, at least a shared portion of the DC universe, with Swamp Thing and Constantine and Shade the Changing Man and Sandman. And for real comic book nerds out there who remember the book Lucifer, which was one of my favorite comics ever that Mike Carey was writing, when that book ended and Lucifer managed to merge the various versions of creation, I don't think it was by accident that that book came out the exact same week as the last issue of the Infinite Crisis crossover, where we actually saw a merger of various Earths that had been splintered apart. And I think that was at least a nod to the fact that they were trying to do yet another line-wide relaunch at one point or another.
Right.
But then there were books that were completely self-contained, Jack of Fables, The Rifle Brigade, you know, those were Vertigo books. And something else that should be mentioned here, when we did the Warren Ellis episode, we talked quite a bit about Transmetropolitan,
mm-hmm, right,
which was a Vertigo book, but it started off as a Helix book. They also launched a line that was going to lean more towards science fiction. And there were several books that were launched in that. There was a great one called Vermilion that Lucius Shepard wrote. But that was where Transmetropolitan got its start. And the Helix line did not last particularly long. I think it was 2 or 3 years tops before they dropped it. And the books that continued, they brought them into the Vertigo fold. I think that Vertigo was sort of almost like a one-off success that not only did it become a line of very good books, but it also became a shorthand for what was considered non-mainstream books.
Right.
Non-superhero books, even though there were quite a number of superheroes that showed up in Vertigo titles. But they also took things like, you know, Jonah Hex and things that had existed, Kid Eternity, that had existed in the DC universe for a very long time, and they said, we want to bring these back and we want to make them adult, quirky, edgy books. And for the most part, they succeeded. There were a few that I thought fell completely flat, but
mm-hmm,
for the most part, they really did succeed.
I mean, you know, I can see, you know, these titles are not going to go away. They will still exist. But rather than eliminating the imprint, maybe they should have reinvented it with something else. Try something else equally new. Rather than DC becoming, or Marvel for that matter, becoming more and more of a homogenous mass, dominated by a movie franchise on either end.
The only issue I would take with that is that, quite frankly, right now, I think DC is editorially a mess. There has been very little consistency in a lot of what they are doing. They've right. got two or three leftover bits from their last relaunch that still haven't been rectified. Doomsday Clock, the Watchmen tie-in with the DC Universe, is just all over the map, and who knows how long this is going to take. I mean, we're on year five of some mysteries not being solved yet that are still supposed to be central to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with them trying to sort of contain their output to a certain degree. I think they've been very, very scattershot.
Right.
And if bringing Vertigo back into the DC universe in some meaningful narrative way is able to help, I would certainly like to see it. I have no problem with the DC universe that contains all the various fantastic characters that have been in Vertigo. We don't see ratings on comics anymore, which is a good thing.
No, it was funny. I don't know if you saw Into the Spider-Verse, but it opens with the symbol of the Comics Code Authority. And when we watched it the other day, Liz is like, "The Comics Authority? What the?"
Yeah. But, I mean, there was some really, really good stuff in Vertigo.
Yeah.
Jason Aaron wrote a fantastic crime drama called Scalped, which took place on an Indian casino, which felt just like an HBO series, and is notable for having no element of the fantastic at all. Mm-hmm. It was just a straight up crime drama like we're seeing so much of on TV right now. And that was a Vertigo book for the entirety of its run. Sheriff of Babylon, about the military police guy in Baghdad.
Yep, that was a good one.
Is another one, yeah. That was a Vertigo book simply because it was considered an adult non-superhero book.
Mm-hmm.
And these were books that definitely pulled their weight and succeeded storytelling-wise. But the only reason they fell into the Vertigo imprint is because they didn't fit anywhere else in the DC universe. And quite frankly, I would love to see a comics landscape much like the 50s, where you had all your cowboy books and your romance books and everything else coming out under one banner. But that's just me.
So. Yep. Well, I hope that things like that don't get lost. I mean, that's right. My real concern.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And I think that the fact that we're seeing this much stuff, and I think one of the things that is helping that, especially when you look at Vertigo properties, is the fact that everything we wished would happen in the 90s is starting to come true with Vertigo books getting other media exposure. We've had a Preacher series now for three seasons,
mm-hmm.
which has been good. It's been very good. It's taking liberties with the story arc that occurred, but that's going to happen when you do TV. I think they've done a very good job with the characters. And then DC did their DC Direct streaming, and they had introduced an early version of the Doom Patrol and I believe the Teen Titans series that they did on, I want to say CW, but I could be wrong. But they launched the DC Direct with a Doom Patrol series, which was based quite heavily on Grant Morrison's run during the Vertigo years. I thought that series was quite successful, and they followed it up now with the Swamp Thing series, which is about halfway through its run and which has already been canceled due to political shenanigans in North Carolina. but it's about halfway through its run, and I think it's done a very good job. It's not only a very scary TV show without being particularly gory, but the thing that I'm noticing is that both Doom Patrol and Swamp Thing have made an effort to introduce a lot of characters that had been in the book. Doom Patrol brought us Flex Mentallo. It brought us Beard Hunter. It brought us Danny the Street. Swamp Thing has given us a version of the Phantom Stranger, and it's already hinted at the fact that we're going to see Blue Devil by the end of the series, and Madame Xanadu is in there, and these are all characters that have had their own books and their own stories. So I think DC TV has managed to learn one lesson from Marvel, which is when you're doing your media stuff, introduce a few other characters that you might be able to do something with later.
Right.
Which I think has been quite successful. And we just heard this week as we're recording this that, that there's supposed to be a Sandman series coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be interesting.
That's Netflix, not DC Direct.
Right.
Now, what is DC Direct? Right. Is that yet another?
Yeah, it was service? It was another streaming service. And okay. I believe as soon as the series, I believe it was only a couple weeks before they started putting them up onto other streaming services.
Right. Okay.
I'm not exactly certain which one. This is the problem with working in media, is that we never, I tend not to see how customers consume their goods anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always working at it from the industrial level. What I've liked about Swamp Thing is that it's really not trying to retell Alan Moore's run on it, even though it's clearly influenced by Alan Moore's run. This is a fairly original story, but it is taking it from, it's keeping a lot of the original, you know, Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson run when it comes to origins, but it's also bringing in kind of the fact that there is other supernatural forces at work, which is something that Alan Moore did quite a bit.
Right.
And so far it's been good. And like I said, it's been very scary, but as opposed to Doom Patrol, which was for about 80% of the time played for laughs, which I really wasn't expecting. Doom Patrol got released or started coming out right about the same time as the Umbrella Academy.
Which I got through one episode of.
Right. And they were two very similar series when it came to the template that sort of started with X-Men. The whole idea of a group of people being thrown together due to the fact that they're outsiders. And where the X-Men was a metaphor for racism, these are books strictly about being on the outside and being unwanted and being marginalized and being, you know, shoved out of civilization proper.
A theme that oddly enough resonates with a storyline in Wildstorm.
Yes.
So we tie it back. Yay.
What I particularly liked about Doom Patrol, though, was that it did manage to take a lot of storylines that Morrison had written and sort of retooled them a little bit to make it sort of more of a comprehensive TV drama. And given the fact that how many characters they shoved into this, and by the time you get to episode 4, we're just completely off the rails. Anything can happen. A magician walks in and unzips the wall and goes into another, you know, time, etc. But I thought it was much fun. I would love to see much more of the Doom Patrol type stuff. I really haven't watched most of the other DC TV stuff, Supergirl and Black Lightning and. And I know there's a lot of it, and I know that it's quite successful, and they've done some really big crossovers. And I know they brought the TV version of John Constantine back.
Right.
Which was, you know, started off in DC and then became sort of a mainstay of the Vertigo universe. So it's definitely there, but I highly doubt that we're going to see Swamp Thing and Doom Patrol interact with the, you know, with the CW, superhero series, Flash and things like that. Even though it has to be said that they did bring Cyborg into the Doom Patrol, and he had been running around the DC TV universe for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And he actually ended up playing a central part. And the reason was, I think when they were doing the show, it was noted at the beginning, hey, the Cyborg character is available. Is there any way we can introduce him into this? And him being the product of a quote-unquote mad scientist work sort of fit right in with sort of the craziness that they were doing with Niles Calder and everybody else in Doom Patrol.
Right. So Swamp Thing, no chance of them finding another Swamp, or...
I don't know. I think it's going to depend on what the actual numbers are, but I'm telling you, this has been a really good... It's got enough of a week-to-week inter-character soap opera going on with old loves and old resentments and things mm-hmm. like that, that it maintains its character-based narrative. But at the same time, when it throws something out of the blue at you, it does it in a very effective way.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Swamp Thing is attempting to reconcile what he is with what's going on in the swamp there it's done very, very effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But it's too bad because of the whole tax credit thing with North Carolina. It would be nice if it got enough ratings and enough viewers that they tried to find another home for it.
Oh.
Because it really is good.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. That would be nice.
So what else have you been reading in the world of four colors?
I actually just reread. I heard that there was going to be an HBO series called Midnight Mass, and I wondered if it was based on the old Vertigo comic, and I went back and reread a couple issues of that. I have really been enjoying the Aliens Dust to Dust, which Gabriel Hardman and Rain Barreto are doing. I thought that was really good, but when it comes to non-licensed stuff, Magnificent Miss Marvel has been rather interesting. I was not expecting Saladin Ahmed to go where he did with it. It's been fun, and I've been kind of wincing my way through War of the Realms. I've said before, I love Jason Aaron. I will read anything that Jason Aaron writes, but Malekith is such a bad villain. And Jason Aaron is, I think, obsessed with Malekith because he's used him as an antagonist about six times in his various Thor runs.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets to be a little tiring after a while. It's been interesting to see Conan back in the Marvel Universe. If anybody had a chance to see the big fight between Conan and Wolverine,
oh, God,
which took place in, I can't remember what book it was in, but I'll put a link up to it. It was quite humorous. It was done quite well. And so I'm sort of interested into how this is going to play out. I don't think him interacting with the Marvel Universe proper is going to be a common thing, but it was a nice little gimmick to get people to come back in.
Right.
And the one other thing that has been kind of, I'm going to call this a guilty pleasure because it really is, Scott and David Tipton have written so much Star Trek and Doctor Who stuff for IDW, and right now they are doing this franchise-wide crossover with Star Trek called the Q Conflict.
Okay.
Which is basically their attempt to involve every single character in the Star Trek universe and sort of pit them against each other. There's this game going on between Q and Trelane and Metron and other very, very powerful alien beings where they're pitting various teams of Star Trek characters against one another, and slowly the characters are finding ways to trick their captors. And it's a fairly ridiculous premise, but it gives you the chance to see some characters interact who you never got a chance to see interact in Star Trek. And it, I'm not even going to call it a successful book, but at least once an issue, something happens that makes me go, you know, that's really clever. That's a really clever bit of writing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to slog through a lot of fan service to get to it. But when it happens, it happens. And it works really, really well.
Nice.
And I think the Hawkman book by Venditti and Conrad, which had had art by a few other people. It's a interesting acceptance of Hawkman's weird, twisted history, but it's also been sort of interesting because it almost feels like it's taking place outside of where we're seeing Justice League and Superman and Batman right now. And Grant Morrison's Green Lantern is doing the same thing. It's definitely, it feels like it is an event book that's sort of existing outside of DC proper right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been a very good science fiction tale as well, which is something that I've been happy about, because Green Lantern is one of those books that tends to forget that it's a science fiction book.
Well, I've been fortunately buying more stuff than I've been reading, so I've got like a million Star Wars titles that I have to catch up on. But I did get through Gibson's Alien 3, which is now an audiobook, mm-hmm. Which is, maybe I'll pick that up, because getting the stars of the movies into the book would be interesting. And that was okay, but kind of thin. I mean, I feel kind of the same way with this one as I did his earlier, his time travel miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, great, but I'd rather have another Gibson novel.
Right.
Then I've been reading a lot of the Sandman universe stuff, and I'm running very hot and cold on it. I mean, I think the best could be the Books of Magic series, which is Kate Howard and Tom Fowler and Jordan Boyd.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying that one the most. The Dreaming was okay. What else was there? House of Whispers, again, okay. And Lucifer, again, okay. But, I mean, the Dreaming and the Books of Magic are the only two that I really look forward to reading. The one totally non-superhero, non-noir, non-anything title that I've really liked is a title called Giant Days.
Yeah.
Which I'm up to, I think, is it like 50 issues in? I have to stop saying episodes. It's not a TV series, Fred. But it's like 50 issues in or so. So I've really enjoyed that one. Tried to get a few other people hooked on that, because it is kind of funny. And then, of course, all the Ellis stuff. A bunch of Captain Marvel and Ms. Marvel and Miles Morales, of course. But the stuff that I really kind of liked is, now I can't remember who wrote it, but I did pick up like three independent titles, Pearl, Cover, and Scarlet or something or other. It's the same writer each one. And I've liked Cover and Pearl. Pearl is particularly interesting in that you've got a couple of hitmen, or hitman and a hitwoman, who are also tattoo artists. And it's this whole, you know, Chinese mafia or whatever you want, you know, kind of a turf war going on. So, again, no magic or whatever. I guess you would call it comic noir. But beautiful art, because especially since you've got the tattoos involved, beautiful art. So that one I really recommend. And that's about... Oh, yeah, Brian Bendis. That's who's doing those three.
Oh, yeah.
Pearl, Cover, and Scarlet.
That's right.
Scarlet is kind of, I guess, a sequel to an earlier title of the same name, which I haven't bought yet. So that might be one of the reasons why I don't like it. I think it... Or I don't like it as much. It ties, I think, deeply into whatever the predecessor was. So maybe I just have to go back and buy the predecessor and read that first before I can really enjoy it. But Pearl and Cover were both, I mean, Cover is kind of interesting. It's spies who are comic artists or comic writers. So you've got a lot of, you know, self-referential stuff that, you know, in it, you know, Comic Cons kind of things. But that was a good, it was a good story. I could see that being made into a miniseries on Netscape, you know, especially if you look at some of the stuff they've done with John Le Carre or Killing Eve right now or Berlin Babylon, things like that. Yeah. You know, this would be a good subject for that. Same with Pearl. That would be a really good subject for a miniseries. Or a movie along the lines of Atomic Blonde, you know, something like that. So those I really enjoyed. So that's my comic reading.
One other book I should mention. Amy Chu is writing for Dynamite Comics, Red Sonja and Vampirella Meet Betty and Veronica.
Oh, Lord.
And the first issue was as ridiculous as you'd expect it to be, but it was also quite a bit of fun. And this is something that we're seeing a lot of now, these out of the way, you know, we had Star Trek Planet of the Apes. We had, you know, these assorted crossovers that have been occurring. And this is one of those ridiculous ones. Maria Sinapo is the artist, and she's doing a fantastic job. It's very, very nice. It almost, at some points, it looks like an old Cry for Dawn comic, also from the 90s. Also another byproduct of the Vertigo years.
Right.
But yeah, it's been fun. I've liked it.
All right, well, that's a good number of titles for everyone to go out and buy.
Yes, definitely. Or at least inspect their see if it's their speed. Was there anything else? Did you watch Good Omens?
Yes, I did. And before we get to watching Good Omens, I mean, I know you were of a generally secular bent, if I recall correctly.
That is true.
And you may, or people may know that I am more of a Roman Catholic bent.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you, Jeff, there's nothing that makes me sadder than, as a Catholic, as how Christians behave. Especially when you're too stupid to put up a petition to cancel a show, which is really a miniseries, so you really can't cancel it. And you don't even petition the correct network.
Yeah.
So, God, Jesus wept, you know, people. There's more important things to complain about out there, like the many of the political situations going on around the world than a TV series. But I enjoyed it. Our whole family enjoyed it. We enjoyed the two leads. We enjoyed the secondary characters for the most part. I mean, I thought the character of the older Witchfinder and his harlot girlfriend were quite amusing. But the whole bureaucracy of heaven and hell and the two guys trying to get around it, you know, that left me screaming a lot. It was so hilarious. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think there's the one image of David Tennant in the burning car.
Yeah.
And he says something about, God, I hated the 14th century. I've got a screenshot of that, and I just have to tweet that out every now and then because it was so hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, and you can just see, like, you know, making, trying to get the other demons to explain, you understand, well, I brought the cell phone network down. Yeah, so what? Don't you realize how much negative energy I generate? It's like, yep. There we go. Civilization in a nutshell. And that kind of led me to watching, I don't know if you've seen any of the Discworld miniseries, but we watched, Going Postal, which is, of course, takes place in Ankh-Morpork, has some of the City Watch in it, but it's the first Moise von Lipwick stories, which are among my favorites, along with that's also, it links into Making Money.
Right.
So, I mean, the story's really simplified because they squeeze everything into two episodes, but they pick some really good characters, and there's just a lot of hilarious stuff and, you know, a lot of hilarious social commentary, especially when you think about the internet bubble and the dot-com boom and even the 2008 crash due to, you know, mortgage-backed securities and everything. It's just, it was really, really biting satire. It's what I really miss about not having Terry Pratchett around anymore is that, yeah, they're fantasies, but man, you really got a lot of social commentary out of his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Timeless social commentary.
Yep. I yeah, Good Omens was a rough spot for me because I thought it was a very, very good adaptation of the source material. Possibly the best adaptation that I've seen.
But
I'm not that huge of a fan of the book.
Right.
The book really didn't have me laughing out loud because in my mind it was, we're going to do a satire of a fairly ridiculous story.
Mm-hmm.
I've always taken the Book of Revelations to be this oddly surreal piece of outsider art, and we're going to do a satire based on that. And in my mind, they sort of set themselves up for a impossible task in that regard. And I understand why people love it, and I understand why it's as wildly popular as it is. The only place where I think the series failed was when I read the book, I always heard Crowley's dialogue as being very, very rapid fire and succinct.
Mm-hmm.
The only way I can put it is if you've ever watched the movie Barton Fink,
yeah,
yep. Where it's so obviously scripted and the timing of the dialogue is so utterly perfect. And David Tennant really didn't do that. He had a lot of hems and haws and shrugging and ah wells. And I expected it to be a bit more punchy. It was all very good. Him terrorizing his houseplants was a brilliant piece. And everybody did a fantastic job in it, too.
I mean, one thing, I know that Neil Gaiman was a fan of Douglas Adams and a friend.
Right.
And I'm not too sure about Terry Pratchett. But I really felt a Douglas Adams' influence in, like, the narration.
Yes.
You know, the opening narration where, like, they would explain something. That just felt so much like a Douglas Adams sideshow in mm-hmm. Hitchhiker's Guide or something where, you know, the whale and the goldfish bowl, you know, mm-hmm. get produced by the extra-dimensional drive or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. It just, yep. It's like I'm sitting there going, that's definitely a Douglas Adams kind of attitude here.
Well, I think that's also a product of the time because Hitchhiker's Guide was such a big splash when it came out in book form. It had been, you know, records and radio shows before that, but when it came out in book form and then when the BBC miniseries aired over here, I mean, that was huge. Nobody had ever had the lack of respect for the genre of SF to go full-blown comedy and make the comedy based on the science fictional elements of it, as opposed to just having a funny character in a science fiction story, which a lot of people had done. You know, Larry Niven had a ton of science fiction comedies.
Mm-hmm.
But this was actually taking the science fictional elements and using that for the source of the comedy and then bringing in these quirky characters that made it work. And that's something that you saw, you know, Red Dwarf did the same thing. And you know, I've talked before about, you know, how much science fiction comedy there is out there now with things like Rick and Morty and Future Man and a few other, you know, series that have come and gone over the years. But I think, you know, that was such a big splash that I think actually stitching the comedy into the fabric of the narrative itself was something that Douglas Adams really gave people license to do. And I think Good Omens was definitely one of the biggest, you know, after effects that had.
Right.
And like I said, it was a spectacular adaptation that managed to keep everything about the spirit of the book to it, which is I mean, I've had mixed feelings about the two seasons of American Gods. It's everyone's doing a fantastic job, and they're doing a lovely job of setting up this sense of dread of what's happening next. But every single episode feels like it could have had 5 or 6 minutes shaved off of it, where you've got this sort of, you know, oh, look, here's Shadow waking up again, not knowing what's happening. Okay, we get it. He's out of his element here. Yeah, so it's been, you know, it's been good. I've liked it, and I will continue watching it. I just think that as adaptations go, it's a tiny bit off the beam and a little unfocused as of what it's trying to do, as opposed to something like Preacher, which is clearly not trying to be a literal adaptation of the Garth Ennis comic, but definitely has a clear direction that it is moving in. And like the other series I mentioned, has introduced a lot of characters from the comic,
right,
and have made them not only at least relatable, but have made them something that we want to see more of. And it's, you know, this is another series that is taking a biblical concept and really, really running with it and being completely off the chain with it. The only other series that I think that has managed to get that crazy was Happy on Sci-Fi, the two seasons of Happy on Sci-Fi, mm-hmm. Which was based on a Grant Morrison thing, another Vertigo veteran. But once again, it's getting to the point where, okay, anything now goes story-wise, and we can now run in a certain direction, provided it can be tied into the development of the plot. You know, all of that goes back to the Douglas Adams thing. I didn't think we see nearly as much of that before we hit the early 80s, and now we're starting to see it saturate into mainstream. If you told me that somebody was going to, that AMC was going to make a Preacher series and make it as violent and sexual and depraved as it is, with God walking around in a Dalmatian outfit in an S&M gimp house, and you know, souls being sucked out of people's necks, and the crazy vampires, it's unexpectedly successful at doing what it's trying to do. Real quick, I also have to mention, if nobody watched it, if you've had a chance to see What We Do in the Shadows, the series, I highly recommend it. I was not a huge fan of the movie when it came out, but the series has been spectacular, especially the episode where they have to go before the Vampire Council, and they're all played by people who have played vampires in other properties.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. It's Paul Rubens is there from the original Buffy and the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. Wesley Snipes shows up on Skype. Yeah, it's well worth watching, and it's been very funny. Not only has it been funny, but it's actually managing to lay down some really good narrative threads as it goes too. Highly recommend it.
Okay.
So what else? We got anything else we got to talk about?
I think we've entertained people's credit cards enough for one night.
Well, let's hope so.
I mean, hopefully, when San Diego Comic-Con rolls around, we're going to actually find out when the next season of The Expanse is coming out.
Yeah,
I feel like we've been waiting forever for that.
Yeah, there's a lot that we're waiting on right now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Well, very good. Nice talking to you again. Good talking to all the folks out there as well. We got some very good feedback with our first episode. I was quite happy to see a few, a handful of people were happy to see us back. So.
Mm-hmm. And we should be back real soon. And maybe next time we'll talk about those book things that we also enjoy.
Oh, yes, books. I remember those.
Yep. Yeah, I read a few this year, so.
Yeah, so have I.
Time to talk.
All right. Yep. Well, hope everybody has a good week, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.